This is KUOW Seattle. In February of 2016, Andre Taylor was in Los Angeles when he got a phone call from his stepmom in Seattle. She told him his little brother, Shay, had been shot by the police.
And I told her, well, let's wait till we get some clarity on it. I don't want to panic right now. Let's just get some clarity on it. And so our family went to the hospital, and we were there for a couple of hours and find out that he had passed away. A day later, the video came out, the dash cam video, and it was very disturbing to see what we felt as a family, that my brother was complying to police officers' commands, and hearing from law enforcement saying that the reason why he was shot is because he wasn't complying with law officers' commands. That was tough. Seeing something happen to somebody that you love, your little brother, is almost like your son. You wrestle with him when he's younger. Of course, he got much bigger than me later. But it was very difficult for me and the family, but he was very close to me, you know.
Shay Taylor was standing next to the open door of a car. The two officers said he was reaching for a gun when they fired. Today, Andre Taylor is working with an organization called De-Escalate Washington to change state law to make it easier to bring a police officer to trial. Right now, in order to prosecute an officer in Washington state, you have to prove they acted with malice or in bad faith. Andre Taylor says that law doesn't work.
This law was instituted in 1986. So the Seattle Times came out with an article saying from 2004 to 2015, 214 people were killed by Washington state officers, and not one officer in all that time was ever convicted, held accountable for a crime. Not one. Mathematically, that is impossible. That in all those incidences, an officer didn't do anything wrong. With the John T. Williams incident, where they have found that Ann Burke did not follow policy, but they still could not bring him up on charges, even though he shot the homeless man, John T. Williams, in his back, right? Never bothering anybody. So we have a real problem in our law that probably encourages bad behavior.
How would your state initiative change that language from malice and bad faith to what?
Well, the problem with the law is that good faith intent has no definition to it. It's not defined, right? So we define that. We brought 3-4 attorneys that took a 4 to 5 month process of having a definition of what good faith is. So right now there is a subjective idea of good faith. So we said, well, there has to be two things that an officer has to qualify, good faith subjectively and good faith objectively. In other words, right now when an officer says, I feel threatened or I fear it for my life, that's all he needs to say. The circumstances of the case don't come into place. I'll give listeners a perfect illustration real quickly. If an average citizen commits a murder, there is a homicide investigation that takes place. That homicide investigation might start a year or two before the incident, because they want to find out what was going on leading up to this homicide. Was somebody being unfaithful? What was going on, right? Well, when a police officer uses deadly force, there is no homicide investigation. The only thing that they want to know is that he followed the law. But the law in our state says the only way we can bring you up on charges is we have to know what was in your mind. We will never be able to know what's in an officer's mind. So we have had officers that have never been held accountable in 214 cases from 2005 to 2014.
So what's the new standard that you want?
The new standard is a good faith standard, that your good faith standard has to be objective, right? So now we can bring in the circumstances of a case, which we couldn't before. We could see whether your behavior comes into play. Now our law don't bring an individual's behavior into play, right? Perfect illustration. The officers gave my brother commands. If those commands that the officers gave my brother put him in a place, right, that made them feel threatened, my brother should not be responsible for that. They should. But there's a de facto immunity in our law, which is problematic. We want to take that de facto immunity out of the law, not to make it easier to prosecute officers. That's not what it's for. To make it possible. It's not even possible in our state.
What punishment would those officers have faced for shooting your brother if this new initiative, this new law were in place?
I don't know if I want to use punishment. I don't know.
Accountability?
It's more accountability. So there would be a process that goes forth and a jury would decide what that officer was responsible for. Right now, a jury can't decide that. And we're trying to change that. We're trying to untie the hands of prosecutors because right now the hands of prosecutors are tied. They cannot bring an officer up. Like I said, one of the most egregious cases is with John T. Williams when the police department found that Emberg violated police policy, but they still couldn't bring him up on charges because of de facto immunity in our law. We want that to be changed.
As you know, the people who defend the status quo here are saying we put these officers, we put guns in their hand, we put them in deadly situations and give them the responsibility to make that split second decision, mm-hmm. and we can't then hold them accountable for doing what they thought was right in the moment, right? That's basically the argument?
And when I've heard people say that argument, I've said to them that I believe that we have the greatest military in the world because we have disciplined soldiers. And when we send soldiers across the world to face alleged enemies and we tell them not to fire, even if you're being fired upon until we tell you to fire, and those soldiers obey underneath those circumstances against an alleged enemy, how then can a police officer say that he can't have restraint for citizens? That argument doesn't pass the smell test with me.
Andre, another part of your initiative, 940, involves de-escalation training mm-hmm. and mental health training. Officers already get training. In fact, in Seattle, one of the officers involved in the killing of Charlena Lyles had received the 40-hour crisis intervention training. How do those requirements change?
40 hours or 8 hours is not sufficient for an officer that has been on the force for 5-10 years, because a person is always predisposed to go back to a behavior that they're comfortable with, right? So if he's been trained to kill, center mass, to put you down, right?
Center mass meaning shoot, you're pointing at your own chest.
Right. If you've been trained that way, and officers have said they are trained to put you down, to kill you, then if you only had 8 hours of de-escalation, if a situation comes about, you're going to resort back to what you've been trained for 10, 15 years, right? So there needs to be a continual training, right? So that officers begin to operate in this new training, but that takes time. 8 hours is not enough time. 40 hours is not enough time.
You also want mandatory first aid training for officers.
The rendering of first aid.
The rendering of first mm-hmm. aid. So they've got to, that part becomes part of their job, that they give first aid to somebody who's down, and that's personal for you with your brother.
It is personal. I think that we've seen incidences around this country that people might have had the opportunity to live, but there was no first aid training given fast enough, right? Now, we don't want to give you a perfect illustration. If an officer is in a situation where there's some type of sniper where it might render him kind of, you know, impossible at that time to render first aid, that's understandable, right? But in my brother's case, he was shot, you handcuffed him, you touched him. He was no threat to you. At that moment, you should have rendered first aid. You had multiple officers around to secure the scene, but they didn't. So then that bias comes in, right? Maybe they wanted him killed. Maybe they didn't like him. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just saying, to prevent that, let's make something mandatory that you should render first aid if you've shot somebody.
I'm talking with Andre Taylor, who is the big brother of Shea Taylor, who was killed last year in North Seattle by police. Andre, do you mind if I talk to you a little about what this is like for you?
Of course.
Because I saw you quoted as saying, let's see if I have it in front of me. I just thought it was a beautiful way to put it, so I wrote it down. I saw you quoted as saying, The system does not respond to people's pain.
Mm-hmm.
It responds to people's organizing. If pain and hurt is not bridled, it can lead to individuals acting out on that pain. And I got this image of you trying to rein in your own, to bridle your own pain, to get through this.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that right? And what is that like for you?
Well, if I have an advantage of looking at things historically, and you see things that have worked and things that have not worked. And as of late, you've seen around the country, people are extremely frustrated, and they should be, and they are in pain, and they should be, because they've lost their loved ones. But what I haven't seen is that the system respond to that in any significant way. And so when I came back to Seattle when my brother was murdered, I decided that we would do things a little differently with my organization, not this time. We would create a safe place where we can have real dialogue and real conversation, right? But I would have to do it first before I could talk about doing it, right? So we talked to Chief of Police Kathleen O'Toole. I sat down with her and I told her, I know I can't bring my brother back, but I believe that if we work together, we could reduce the incidences of violence in our community. And I'm willing to work with you to do that. That's a different narrative. That challenges the system and it sets a precedent for my own community, right? Because I've seen that work before in the past. And there's no sense of trying to create the will. I've seen having a big tent. I don't care who you love. I don't care what you look like, what religion you're from. If you're about social justice, come be a part of this and help us and let's work together. So we went and talked to Latino organizations, Native tribes, and we got white allies. And I said, we have to be a big tent, nothing small, nothing marginalized, right? And we together can make it happen. That has worked before in the past. And that is the only way that we secure change for our future. Even though I've got pushback from my own community at times because they fear. They fear. Some people in my community, and rightfully so, they fear having white allies. They fear because of past incidences where they feel they've been taken advantage of. Maybe promised something from a politician and the promises never came about. But you have to lead by example and you have to show through the work. Because once you show through the work will speak for you.
How do you get pushback?
Well, you get pushback because people are in fear. They're saying, like, you know, these people have promised this, that, and the other, and we're still in the same situation that we've been in, right? So my argument to my own community—
They don't want to work within the system because they feel the system isn't for them?
Exactly. You know, so you have to show how you can. You can't just go talking, especially my community that have been— historically abused, right? You can't just go selling them a dream. You have to bring them the evidence that what you're saying works, is tangible, and it's real. And that's what we've been doing at Not This Time. And I think that's why we've had an opportunity to kind of further things.
Can you relate to that desire to stop being constructive and be angry and open your pain? Can you feel that impulse?
I understand it. Right. But it's not about me. It's about the furtherance of my people. It's about the furtherance of justice. So I can't be about me. Right. And you have to have vision. Right. You have to think about what is going to be 10 years. What are you going to leave to the generation after you? Is there a big enough foundation you can leave them that they can build upon? It's not about me, even though I have personal pain. But that's what leadership is. You have to lead. And I always say this, and I say this at Not This Time all the time. If you're a leader and you haven't learned to love beyond your pain, you shouldn't be a leader.
How do you do that? How do you learn? Because it's hard for me. It's hard for a lot of people. How do you learn to love beyond your pain?
I have no other choice, because if you're dealing with the system or you're dealing with your own people that are full of trauma, from years of circumstances in this country, your people will respond to you with that trauma and with that pain, right? And you have to understand the onus then becomes on the individual that claims to be a leader. You have to take that in, understand that, and still show through example why we must operate this way, right? So again, the way you do that is not thinking about yourself. I wake up every day willing to sacrifice for the good of the future. for my people ultimately. But you have to show that. Yeah, that's how.
Andre Taylor is the brother of the late Shea Taylor, and Andre is now leading a group called De-Escalate Washington. They are kicking off signature gathering today for an initiative to make it easier to prosecute police officers who use deadly force, and it would require more mental health and de-escalation training. So that's an initiative to the people, to the voter. That's one way to change state law. But you know, some Washington lawmakers tried to change this law on police use of deadly force, but the bill didn't make it out of committee. Let's talk now to Republican Representative Dave Hayes, who represents Ireland and parts of Snohomish County in the state legislature. He does not support this initiative 940. He's also a sergeant with the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office, and he says he knows from personal experience why the language of the state law should not change.
There's one in particular situation that I was involved in many years ago. I was a young deputy working up in the Tulalip area, Marysville area, and walked in, and there's a man there that he plowed over the back of a female. And what I didn't understand at the time, I walked into this situation, and they were fighting over a knife. And I had no idea what the situation was. And one thing that I'd like to point out to folks is that law enforcement officers are called to and expected to go into situations where they don't know all the facts. They walk into the middle of a situation that the facts are not plainly observable. In this particular situation, there was a man over the back of a woman. They were both in standing position fighting over this knife. And what I didn't realize at the time was that the man was trying to take the knife away from the female who had been threatening others and herself with this knife.
What happened to that man and that woman?
In that particular situation, I followed my training and experience. I'd been a law enforcement officer at the time for about 6 or 7 years at the time, so I was no spring chicken. But I drew my weapon and had it at low ready and began giving verbal commands. And this isn't a situation that a law enforcement officer wants to go and put hands on. The woman released the knife and stepped away. The man now had the knife. I gave him verbal commands and he followed them. But it was one of those very tense situations that I walked into and I didn't realize what was going on.
Are you saying you could have made what an outside group in hindsight could have seen as a mistake because in the moment you might have feared for your life without having all the facts?
Correct. I could have. Maybe a less experienced officer would have made a different decision. Maybe a more experienced officer would have made a different decision even than I made. And sometimes we're put into situations where there's two officers, one shoots and the other one doesn't, or one takes an action and the other one doesn't. And there's always questions around that. There's always questions about why didn't we use less lethal use of force and why aren't we trained to use less lethal first. And quite frankly, we are, but every single situation is different.
Washington law states that an officer can't be convicted of a crime for using deadly force if she or he acted in good faith and without malice, or what the law calls evil intent. But how could a jury ever know that an officer is acting with malice or evil intent?
Well, that comes down to the facts and circumstances surrounding that the situation that the officer was placed in, and the actions that the officer makes, the statements that he or she makes. So there's a collection of evidence process that any investigation would follow that would determine those facts and circumstances that might lead to whether or not the officer acted with or without malice.
Well, for example, Washington State has a relatively strict law here. There are states where the law says an officer can shoot if they have a reasonable fear of death or great bodily harm. If they are deemed to have a reasonable fear, why couldn't Washington State law use that definition instead of a malice standard?
Well, what's the intent of making the change in the first place? So is the intent to improve public safety, or is the intent to prosecute police officers? That's the question that folks are going to need to answer for themselves. Will this new law change the way law enforcement officers do our job, or will it not? Will changing that charging standard lead to a safer community, or will changing that charging standard simply put more put law enforcement officers in jail, or hold them more accountable?
Well, that word accountable is the key to what the advocates for this law change are saying, that public safety is important and officer accountability. That's what this is about.
Right, and I certainly understand that. So, but will it necessarily change anything? If you go to those other states and do an analysis across our nation and see which states officers are being charged with crimes and which states they're not, even those states with what would be perceived as being a lower charging standard, you know, you made that made reference to just the term reasonable. Even in those states, officers still aren't being charged with crimes.
That's true. It just happened in Minnesota with the Philando Castile shooting. That's one of those states that have a lower standard.
Right. So, yeah, and in that particular case, he was charged, probably rightfully charged, and the jury made the decision that they made based on the facts and circumstances presented to them in court. So, and that kind of brings me back to, what is the intent of making this change? Is the intent to make more prosecutions, or is the intent to make it a safer community? And I believe that there are better routes to creating a safer community than simply changing that charging standard.
Let me just ask you about a couple of other ingredients in this state initiative proposed. One is that it calls for more mental health and de-escalation and first aid training for officers. What do you think of that requirement of more training?
Well, one thing that I'd like to point out is it seems to me that there's a misconception out there in the public or in these the communities that are making this proposal that we're not getting training in mental health and how to deal with mental health folks. We're not getting training in first aid and de-escalation and all those. We get fantastic training at the Criminal Justice Training Center.
Well, I talked about exactly this with Andre Taylor, who said, yes, police do get training, but we don't understand the way the mind works. If you don't get more and consistent and thorough training, then in a heated situation, you're just going to revert to more instinct and less training, and that we need still more training.
There might be examples of acting on instinct instead of based on training. Is there ever going to be enough training in place to cover every single one of these situations? How much training are we talking about? And as I read that initiative, I felt that it was very subjective. It had very subjective language about how much training is going to be necessary, because it leaves it up to the Criminal Justice Training Center to determine how much training is necessary. Now, the state of Washington has spent substantial resources and already an increasing critical incident training for law enforcement officers. And the critical incident training that I'm talking about, we do talk about de-escalation. We do talk about shoot, no shoot. We do talk about dealing with people with disabilities and mental health. And there's already existing state law that mandates our basic academy trainees to receive training in basic and continuing in service. So can we improve on that? Maybe. But we do already receive substantial training.
Okay, final question, Representative Hayes. I know you're not a fan of doing this through an initiative process to the voters, but what if this were just about because this has come up in the legislature, what if legislators changed Washington State's law to be like most other American states' law and lowering the threshold for prosecuting officers after a shooting? Is there language, legislatively reached language, that you could support on that, or are you a no vote?
Well, there is quite possibly language that I could take a yes vote on, but I would have to see that, and it's going to be, you know, there's already several different definitions out there about the reasonable officer standard. You know, Snohomish County Prosecutor Mark Rowe and another fellow from the city of Seattle, I'm not recalling his name, wrote some that they feel is most appropriate. And that was represented in one of the pieces of legislation that was considered this year. But then there's others that law enforcement have brought forward. So we need to banter those things back around and make sure we're making the best possible decision.
Again, that's Representative Dave Hayes, a Republican from Island County, who's also a sergeant with the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office. He opposes Initiative 40. Supporters of that initiative started gathering signatures today. This is KUOW.